this time your dad and you went out, you were about 19 then?
No, I was 17. Mm-hmm. 17 years old. I hadn't got into the sixth grade yet. I was just promoted to the sixth grade. I went out. See, I was late getting to school, you might say. But I was moving along all right as far as I was concerned. Yeah, I was just going into the sixth grade. I just finished the fifth. And I never got into the sixth.
So, maybe you could tell us more about this year that you went out with your dad.
Well, we went up Doll River. We finally found a place where got to where the water was too shallow to have too much going, easy going. So, we just stopped and made a camp. Built a house there. We whipped out some lumber for next spring, but never used it because Dad died in the meantime. Died in March. As far as I can ever find out, all the books I've read while I was with him or while he was with him, I wanted to take him into Fairbanks. I wanted to go across the Brooks Trail to Fairbanks, Stephen Village, but he wouldn't go. And he died 26th of March, 1923. About 7:30 in the evening in O.P. Russell's store at Stephen Village. We buried him about 3 days later, I guess it was, something like that. O.P. Russell made a coffin that he had one redwood board, big redwood board, and he made a coffin out of that. And I stayed with Russell for maybe 2 weeks, and I didn't feel like he treated me real well, but I just felt like I was encroaching, you know. So I got out again. I know one time I wanted some sweets, you know. So I asked him how much his cookies were, and he told me. So I went out and weighed a pound. I paid him. And then he told me, he says, you don't have to buy anything as long as you're with me here. But I didn't look at it that way. I was never brought up that way. I don't know. It was either my own or it wasn't. That's the way I felt. Because my dad was really independent, you might say, the same way. Although I had nothing against my dad. Whatever I wanted, I always asked my dad, and I'd get the money from him and get what I wanted, or else he'd go and get it, one or the other. And when I made any money, why, just give it to my dad. I didn't even think about anything at all. He didn't drink it up, so I didn't have to worry there. My dad was, I guess you would say, none are very, very moderate drinker. He'd take a drink once in a while. All during Prohibition, he had his own whiskey there. Never bothered. I seen him happy one night when Prohibition went in effect, 1918. Come home, Ed. And he'd come home with a whole bunch of bottles, you know. I gotta go back and get some more. So he went back, got some more. I was asleep when he came back. Next thing I know, next morning, 8 o'clock, breakfast. One time too, he come home a little late. In March, I guess 1922. 21 or 22, he come home. The first time I ever seen my dad really out. He come in, he says, Ed, put the horse away. I can't take care of him. So I put on my coat, went out, brought a couple buckets of water in the house and took the horse to the barn, took him in the barn, took his harness off him, wiped him all down. It was cold, and I wiped him all down, dried him off as best I could, and throw a blanket over him. Nice warm barn anyhow. I had the fire going in there. Yeah, get a little dry hay in there, and I went back to the house, and Dad was sound asleep. So about 9 o'clock that, or 6 o'clock that night, I went out and I fed the horse, gave him some water. About half past nine, I went out there and cleaned his stall out, you know, and threw some old hay underneath him, fed him, put some water in his manger. Checked the fire, went home, went to bed. So I know. Next thing I know, it's breakfast. That's all it was. I never got a licking from my dad. A lot of talkings, but never licking. You know, I was happy. I sure missed him, though. No, I think I learned quite a little from Dad in that respect. Probably more so than if I went somewhere else, you know. He wanted to know if I wanted to go to Chihuahua or go to Holy Cross, and I balked on either both of them. I told him I want to be with you. So I guess I learned quite a little too from Dad.
Died.
As far as I can read on, all the symptoms that he had was pleurisy, which turned to pneumonia. Mm-hmm. And there was no doctor. We had no medicine for him. I went to the mission there, and they didn't have, what is that medicine now? What is that again? Anyhow, it's supposed to dry the fluid up on your lungs. They didn't have it. He died 23rd of March, just exactly 9 years and 9 days difference from Mother. And it must have been, let's see, 8:30, just about 5 hours, because I know they sent for me about 3 o'clock in town in the house when I was in school.
So what did you do after you left? Was it Opie Russell?
Yeah, well, I went hunting rats. I went hunting rats that spring.
Have you done that with your dad before?
Yes, I did once out of town and all. So I went with a fellow by the name of Benjamin Stephen that spring. We got a little over 200 rats. And then I come down river and went to work on the steamer Alaska, decking. Went up to Dawson, back again.
What would you do decking?
Deckhand. Mm-hmm. Handling freight, handling wood, handling, you know, all the dirty stuff on the boat. You might say that's the deckhand's job, is taking care of the boat. All the freights.
So yeah. You saw some new places then?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Then the following year, I went to work on the steamer Yukon. Went up the same route again, all the way up to Dawson and back again. Mm-hmm. Couple of trips. Then I stayed in town and I worked on a steamboat. I worked on a steamer Jacobs. And decked on it. And then, lo and behold, we got a new mate on a steamer Jacobs. Who was it? Fred Racy. The mate I used to work under on a steamer Yukon. He was a strict mate, and I mean strict. You did what he told you to do, or you got good talking to. But he was a good man, regardless. I liked him. I didn't pay no attention to what the other people was thinking, but I just, that was it. I never got any, I had no trouble with him at all. Never. In fact, the second year I worked on a steamer, Jacobs, he was on there, and I was third mate. He'd tell me what he wanted to do, you know, even though I was deckhand, I'd get the other two men to work. I was working the same shift, we'd work, get through. No trouble. I liked him, he was a good mate. He knew his business, in other words, and he told you what he wanted done, he'd want it done that way, and that was it. You done it that way, and there was nothing to it. You know, I liked him. Then I worked with another mate afterwards, Joe Tremel, well before that too. Then I worked on another mate, gosh, what was his name? He was a good mate though. He's a real good mate. And then I had a chance, there was a fireman needed on the boat and I wanted to go firing. And I asked him and he said, no, I can't let you go. And the chief engineer wouldn't hire me because the mate, I was under the mate's jurisdiction yet. So I talked to the mate and it's $25 difference, and easier time. In other words, decking, you work six on and six off, or all 24 hours if necessary. On firing, he was on 6 hours, there's two firemen. He was on 6 hours and 12 hours off. And so it was $25 a month more. And so Fred Joe said to me, well, he says, Ed, I don't want to hold you back. I don't want to hold anybody back from making more money. He says, if you can get somebody to take your place, he says, be fine, I'll let you go. So I says, can I go uptown now? I was in Nana. Sure. So I went uptown. We were loading the barge too. I went uptown. I come back and about an hour afterwards, I had a man. So right away I went to the chief and I got on the chief. Dow, L.M. Dow. And Walter Johnson was assistant engineer. So I went firing. And I learned there was a firing coal. I was learning by the fellow named Axel Johnson. And a big Swede or Norwegian, I don't know which. Anyhow, I was firing coal with him, and as long as he was in the fire hole, I could, nothing worrying when you look at that steam and keeping the fire going, you know. So I thought nothing of it. I got a job anyhow. But the first day that I was on shift and the boat was leaving, I was all alone. Poor old Axel was uptown and had a wing dinger, and he come down. He was counting the ferries, I guess. In bed, and I was on shift, and I was on needles and pins, I guess you'd say, for at least 20 minutes anyhow. When we pulled out, I was on shift. How am I going to do? What are we going to do? I can't hold 200 pounds of steam. That's all there is to it. Check, send, and go. Like I say, maybe 15, 20 minutes, what? Nothing to it. It's home again. That's all right. I didn't worry. So I worked. I worked with under L.M. Dow for 45 months.
How many seasons is that?
That's about nine, I guess. Eight. Somewhere around there, seven or eight seasons.
Well, you're talking about firing. Exactly what was it you would do when you're firing?
You had to keep the steam up in the boiler You had to keep your water up to a certain, you had a water glass on your boiler, and you had to keep your water in between the two marks on that boiler, because if you went up too much below it, well, you'd get a chance to warp your boiler and the water on the top sheet, what they call the crown. So you had to keep the water above that, about 4 or 5 inches above that. And if you got too much, pardon me, if you got too much water, then you would, your engines then would pull the water out into the steam. Instead of getting dry steam in the piston, you'd have wet steam, see? And it would cause condensation in the piston, and you'd have a knock. Probably blow the head out if you get too much water. And
so you have to keep coal in there?
Coal or wood, whichever one. Mm-hmm. You had to keep this fire going. You had to keep a clean fire. When you change shifts, you had to leave a clean fire to your relief. And you had to have the steam up to 220 if you were on the go. And if you were tied up by 175.
What's a clean fire look like?
It's as your fire is in coal, your fire is right at its peak, steady. And you got a clean grates, or your grates are all clean, everything is nice. So the fireman is coming on shift, doesn't have to, pardon me, get down there and really work to get his fire to where he wants it. When you leave that fire, when you left that fire, your fire was in one number one shape for the other man. He didn't have to worry about it for a couple of hours before he'd have to get a few clinkers out of the road. You know, his grates were all clean, everything. You had to clean your fires before your relief come.
What kind of pay were you getting as a deckhand and then when
you were firing? Pardon me. Decking, we got 75 a month. Firing, got 115. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it was quite a bit better.
Mm-hmm. Well, how was the river different then than it is now, traveling on the river, especially on those river boats?
Well, between now, you have no travel, period. At that time, there was a steamboat on the river all the time. Now, when I was working when I first decked, there was boats all over the river, coming and going all the time. You'd see boats coming, and you'd see boats going and passing one another. But towards the last, why, there was only two boats on the river, see? Well, you'd only see one or two pass. You'd see the other boat going one way, and you'd be going the other way. Like you were going up river, and the other boat was coming down river. And then you'd meet one another again when it was going the other direction. And that's all there was on boats. There wasn't too many boats. It was towards the last, there was only two or three, two, four, three steamboats, I guess. Pardon me.
Did you meet many people who lived in villages along the river?
Oh, yes. I met a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did many of them ever ride on the steamboats?
Oh, yes. The steamboats carried a lot of passengers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They carried passengers to and from all the time. And the fare was cheap, too.
What was the fare like?
About 10 on a marshal, or about $30. So you couldn't beat that. And you had, well, you got on a steamboat, you was on a traveling hotel when you were a passenger. It was a traveling hotel. That's all it was.
They have food and everything on it?
Three meals a day plus midnight lunch, and then you had waiters. Dinner bell would ring, and you go up. You had your, if you're a passenger, you had places the waiters show you where to sit down. That was your chair, table. Yeah. When deckhands, well, we had our own mess hall down below. on Jacob's we ate up on the mid deck. And on the other boats afterwards, we ate down below. We had our own mess hall down below, which was right adjacent to the kitchen.
We've talked to some people who were, you know, just, say 6 years old to maybe 14 years old when the steamboats were going up and down the river, and talk about how they used to run out to the bank to see it. Did you used to see a lot of kids doing that in their camps?
I used to see them do that day and night when we were passing by. Yeah. Oh, yes. Have to go out and see the steamboat go by.
Was that an exciting time?
Well,
on the river?
I'm going to tell you one thing. What used to happen in Tandon when I was going to school, the first boat coming down river was coming into Tandon. As soon as that whistle blew, regardless of what time it was, and when we were in school, school was out, just like that. And we went all up with the teacher. We all went with the teacher. We didn't run away from her. We didn't lag behind. We all stayed right together. And we stayed with her and to watch, see the boat land and people come on and go. And after that little, maybe there 20 minutes or a half an hour, you know, then we'd all go back to school again. But that was it for the first boat. After that, no matter how many boats come in while we were still in school. But we used to go to school from September 1st or thereabouts to June 15th.
Well, you said that there were a lot of steamboats and then there were only two. What caused that?
After the railroad come in, then it cut down the steamboat run. There was four steamboats, really, because the steamer Alaska and steamer Yukon was running passengers only. Well, they had a little freight too, but mostly passengers between Whitehorse or Dawson and Tanana. They had 100 passengers each way. They'd pick them up at Tanana, and they'd pick them up, discharge them at Tanana or at Whitehorse or Dawson, then pick a load downriver, discharge them at Tanana.
Why were people traveling?
Or Nenana, rather. It's tourists. Why? Tourists. Yeah. That was a tourist trade. They'd pick a load up at Nenana. I said Tanana. They'd pick a load up at Nenana. They'd go up to Dawson. They'd discharge that load there, and then they'd pick up another load, come back down to Nenana again with another bunch. And the railroad was taking them and bringing them in, and the White Pass on the upper end was bringing them down. And they'd make a circuit, in other words. If you come in from Seward, you know, you'd make the circuit all the way up to Skagway and out that way.
What kind of people would be tourists?
Oh my gosh. What kind? All the Elite Whites was coming in, traveling along the river. You might say, you know, tourists, regular tourists coming through from stateside and coming down through Dawson, coming in by Skagway and down through Dawson and around down the river. And the steamboat would stop at every one of these places. Like they'd stop at Eagle. They'd stop at they'd load on Dawson. They'd come down and stop at Eagle. They'd maybe stay there a couple hours. Then they'd take off and go down to Fort Yukon or Circle and stay there another couple hours just for the tourists, you know, to walk around. Then they'd blow their half-hour whistle, 15-minute whistle, 5-minute whistle, and then they'd go. Then they'd stop at Fort Yukon, do the same thing all over again. And Beaver, they'd do the same thing. So they give you a, what would you call that? You know, you really enjoyed your trip. You could stop at each one of these different stops all along the river. You know, like you leave Dawson, then you stop at Eagle, Circle, Fort Yukon. And then Beaver, Stephen Village, and Rampart, and Tanana, and Hot Springs. You didn't too far back in, but I don't know. Maybe they did stop long enough to run back into Hot Springs. It's 4 miles away from the main Tanana River. Tolovana didn't stop, but all the way to Nenana and Minto, they didn't stop.
Well, what was it like when one of these boats stopped in a village and everybody got out? What happened?
Well, we just didn't do anything. We just waited. It was like I say, we were on the boat. We just wait. Maybe we'd go ashore and buy an item or two at the store and get right back on the boat again. Because we were tied up to the boat. We were. But the other passengers or tourists, they went ashore and they'd buy and walk around and take pictures, you know. That was it.
How'd they get along with the what did the people think of the tourists?
Well, I don't know. I don't think they never even give them a thought. Just we'd go over and gawk and see who they were. And that's all there was to it. As far as I know.
Were there any businesses that depended on the tourists coming through buying?
Well, I guess the stores. Yeah. The stores all had trinkets for them, you know, native goods. At that time, natives did a lot of sewing. Moosekin, beadwork, everything. Parkies. Later, I worked in the store at Tanana, in the NC store at Tanana. There was nothing when the tourists come in to take in $500 or $600 in a couple of hours. You know, because I worked in there with the agent and I, and we didn't even go to the cash register. We didn't have time. There's too many people buying this and buying that. We kept all the change in our pocket. We'd clean out our pocket before the boat come in when the whistle blew, clean our pockets out, and that was it. That was our cash register from then on. after everything was closed up again, then we'd empty our pockets out and count up the money, and didn't make any difference who took in the most money. It was all right there to ring up. That was it. We didn't even have time to write down what we sold. Too many people. Yeah.
Well, after you started working firing, what was your next job on the boats?
My next job. Well, I worked 45 months, I think it is. And the old man went after me. And I wouldn't listen to him.
Which old man is that?
Name L.M. Dow, Leon M. Dow. And I promised him, but I didn't go through with the promise that winter. He wanted me to study my books. He says, I want you to read up on the books. He says, you've got all the practical knowledge, and I want you to get the book knowledge. Read up. I said, okay, Chief, I'll do that. But that's as far as it went, that winter. So he went after George Adams the same way. George promised him faithfully. We both were nice boys. We both faithfully promised. We also faithfully broke our promise. So we didn't read up on the books at all, steam engineering. Next spring I got on the boat. Well, how'd you make out, Ed? As chief, I didn't read the book. Ooh. And I get a good talking to. I really got a talking to. I promised him, okay, chief, I'll start reading the book. Inspectors should not have been in until about August, so I had lots of time. But I started to read the book anyhow. So he asked George. George faithfully read the book as well as I did. So he got the same. So we both started in. We're both oiling. While he was oiling in the afternoon or in the evening, early morning, I was reading the book. And then I was oiling too at the same time, doing my chores in the engine room. Okay, and then we got to Nenana, we got to Marshall. What'd we do? We met the inspectors at Marshall, Coast Guard inspectors, two people that we had never seen before in our lives, new men. We seen the other ones from the soldiers. Sabine Elcraft and Charles H. White, why, I had seen them from when I was 16 years old. And I was, what was I? I'd seen them for at least 18 years or 20 years. And we run into a fellow by the name of Dickert and another fellow. Dickert was the chief engineer, Coast Guard. The old man didn't know them either. So he began feeling them out. And we were reading the books, George and I. And he began feeling them out. Took him quite a little, took him about 2 days to feel them out. Finally, I guess this Dickert asked him, Chief, now would you take, say you were going on a cruise around the world for a year, no other ports, that is, no American ports after you left America, the States, would you take these men as your assistants? The chief says, yes, I'll take them. I take them because I don't care, he says, I can depend on them. Even if I tell them to do something, make something for me to do it, they'll do it the way I want it done. Even though it is wrong, they'll do it the way I want it done. They know it's wrong. They'll do it the way I want it done, and that's it. He says, I can depend on them. So then we were on the job. And it was a nightmare for 5 days between reading the book and answering questions and oiling. I tell you, it was 5 days, I guess, or more. I don't know, George and I, we finally made it anyhow. But the chief knew we had made it. I think it was about the 10th or 11th question that we had answered. The chief knew we had made it. All of us doing, you know, two questions in that 10 or 15 questions. There was two questions in there. They were not together, but there was two questions. And it was the crucial questions. If you missed either one of them, you had another 6 months, or up here in Alaska, you had another year.
Another year before what would happen?
Before you could take another test. And one of them was the stayboat problem, bursting power of stayboats, and boilerplate when there are certain pressures. And the other was safety valve problem, whether you had some, the safety valve problem was, both of them are ticklish, really. Really ticklish questions. The safety valve problem can work too. Mine was, pardon me, different than George's. I had to place the weight, a certain weight, at a certain distance from the fulcrum of the safety valve to let the safety valve open up at a certain pressure. And George's was the other way around. He had to figure the weight out at a certain distance. Me, I had to figure the distance from the fulcrum. So the steam pressure, 200 pounds, is lift. And relieve the boiler of the excess pressure. But we both passed. And then I went to Tannenau. We got into Tannenau and I had to go for physical examination, or physical, you know. And I had astigmatism in one eye. The doctor wrote down incompetent. And that was all. I didn't pay no attention to it. And chief, we got down. I had to get down. We both got down to the boat just 12 o'clock. George had to wash up and eat, he had to wash up and eat. I had to wipe up and clean up and get ready to wash up. So when George come down, why, I was all ready for him. Chief said, well, how'd you make out? Well, I said, I don't know, chief. I says, I got doctor wrote incompetent for me. What do you write that down for? I said, I don't know. What's the matter? I said, something pertaining to my eyes. That's all I know. Why did he write incompetent? You know, it just bothered him. It really bothered him. Boy, I don't know. For the next 20 minutes, I was just answering questions to the chief about that. Did he say anything else? Did he say anything else? Well, I said, no. I said, chief, he didn't. Even then, I washed up and I was all cleaned up because I was eating upstairs, oiling, so, you know, eating upstairs. And I was sitting at my table, just about the distance of you from the engineer's table, and I was sitting at mine, oiler's table, and I had my, well, I wasn't, I was sitting kind of catty-corner to the chief. Yeah, and I was sitting this way, and, no, I was sitting this way, facing the chief this way, and I didn't see anybody from this side, you know, and, chief asked me, all of a sudden he quit asking me questions. I never thought nothing. I thought maybe so. Pretty soon I heard a voice say, that's right, Ed, eat all you can because I'll be waiting for you. It was just like that light bulb to face, chief's face. What, just like that? Just that quick. From a face that was, you might say, I wonder what's wrong or what it was, you know? To all of a sudden, it was, that's right, Ed, eat all you can because I'll be waiting for you. That was the inspector. So the chief knew then that I had to finish out my questions. So I, that was all that was ever asked. And then I didn't get my license right away because I had to, we did pass. And the chief said, or the, not only Chief Dickert, he said to both George Adams and I, he said, well, Ed, after we'd finished everything, see, we had about 125 oral questions besides the ones that we'd answered, written questions. He says, Ed, George, trouble with you boys were, you were scared of me. He was right. You know, we were really on edge. We didn't know. Because if it had been somebody we really knew, you know, we wouldn't have felt so bad. But somebody we didn't know right from the outside, we've never seen them before in our life. You know, chucks. Who are they and how are they going to treat us or what? You know? Well, George got his license before I did, but I had to get glasses. I didn't get mine until next year. I didn't get my license until the following year. And then I figured, oh, heck with it, you know. All of a sudden, I got a letter. I was working for the Weather Bureau then in New Lano. All of a sudden, I got a letter from Dickert. What are you going to do about your license? Your license is waiting. I want to get a visual examination. He sent, had the paper in there. So I just took that paper and I went over to the telegraph office and I sent a telegram to the Weather Bureau in Anchorage. Going to Galena for checkup. Eye checkup will be gone 3 days. That's all I wrote. That's all I sent. Sent that telegram. I got on plane, went up to Galena. And who was there? There was an Army doctor there. He had no way to check my eyes, only by his own. He had 20/20 vision, so everything he put up there, 15 feet, I read with one eye, with the glasses on. He changed the reading again. He didn't use that same, and he got another magazine, you put that up at that distance, what he could read with his eyes, good. I read him just like that. He says, your eyes are real good. They just signed it right there. Listen, I got my license.
And what was your license?
First assistant engineer, steam engineer, on river boats of 1,200 horsepower, which took in the steamer Nenana. Rivers only. Rivers and bays only. No, it was just rivers only. That was it. So I worked under it on a steamer, Barry Kay, 2 years later. I worked under it. Then I sent my papers in the fifth year for a renewal. And I don't know why. Don't ask me why. I don't know whether George, I never even asked George about him, his license. But they wrote back to me and they want to cut my horsepower down to 12, from 1,200 to 1,000 horsepower, which would put me illegally on the steamer Nenana, all right, but I wouldn't be able to handle her legally, see, because that was 1,200 horsepower engines. So I wrote back and said, no, I want 1,200. Well, I didn't hear anything. I'm working in the Weather Bureau. I didn't hear a thing. All of a sudden, I figured, well, gee whiz, over a month, I better find out what's going on. So I wrote back and asked them if they were going to renew my license or had they just tabled it, you know, and forgot it. About 10 days later, I got a registered letter, return receipt. My license was changed to 1,000 horsepower. Any tonnage, 30 assistant engineer, any tonnage, any waters. That's what it is today.
Why did you do that?
I don't know, but I've got a real good license. I can go out to ocean right now and get a job.
So that's a better license. They changed it to a better thing?
They got a better license.
That's because if it was any waters?
Any waters, any tonnage. I'll get that. The license I got.
Can I open up this thing?
There's nothing, only my thumbprint on there.
I just wanted to take this off so it wouldn't glint, you know?
Oh.
Because he is going to take a picture of it, huh?
Of course. Are you kidding? How can I get him this thing like that?
I suppose you want to stand it up.
Oh, no. This is all right.
So what year was this you first got this license?
This is my, what, third issue? Fourth issue, I think. I have to look and see. I don't want to move it while he's...
Mm-hmm. So your first... Okay. Your first license wasn't what you...
No, it can't be 7. I got it in 1943. And it's renewable every 5 years. Mm-hmm. You gonna take another picture of it?
Uh-huh.
Well, gee, that would make it about 7, 75, mm-hmm. 43.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wait, which one? What? Wait.
Once I get to hold that,
you want me to hold it up? How's it? Wait, I haven't got a steady. Wait a minute. Come back here, you.
So, how did it feel to get that first license?
Felt fine.
Did you celebrate? Did you celebrate?
No. We're going to look for that always.
Trying every
angle. Well, you know, I got to try a different lights, you know. Got it.
And so I just, well, let it go. It's all right with me. I can work on steam and out of cup. Need to be, you know, 1,000 horsepower. But I never did work. I worked on a steamer barricade under this license, which was, I believe, more than 1,000 horsepower. More than 1,200 even, because it was a big engine. It was, I believe, one of the strongest boats on the river, the biggest. It had a 16-inch cylinder and 7-foot stroke. In other words, it was a piston traveled 7 feet to a stroke.
Oh, and 16 inches across.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge.
It is. It was.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, this is good for steamboats. Now,
steamboats is right. You're saying it's good until 1980.
Well,
and nobody else can claim it.